On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. High gas prices are relentlessly eating into American family budgets now. $3 plus a gallon at the pump, $30, $40, $50, $60 for a fill-up. For most families, that's real money. And nationally, it's a huge transfer of wealth from little pockets to big pockets as the oil companies chalk up stratospheric profits. Americans have been taking it in stride so far, but maybe they should be asking more questions, like exactly what's driving the gas price and whether those profits are helping position the country to break its oil addiction. Up next on Point, what's really going on with gas? We will hear today from a consumer advocate, an oil industry economist, and a proponent of lower profits and higher taxes on gasoline. Joining me first from Washington is Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group. Last month, he testified before the House Committee on Energy and Commerce on the factors he sees driving high gas prices. Tyson Slocum, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, Tom.
So give us your sense of the field here. We know oil is tight. The price for a barrel of oil is high. Is that all there is to it? Oil's high, so we're paying more, period, end of story.
Well, of course, you know, global supply and demand is going to play a role here. But there's no question that the oil industry is exploiting the situation. And that's why there's this direct connection between the record profits that oil companies are enjoying and the record prices that motorists are paying at the pump. And it would be one thing if the high prices we were paying at the pump were being channeled into useful investments that would help break our oil addiction. You know, like in Europe, for example, where they pay a lot more than we do for a gallon of gas, but that higher price is being invested into subsidizing mass transit and alternatives like that. Here in the United States, the high prices that we're paying are simply going into the pockets of oil companies and their shareholders.
Okay, since 2001, almost half a trillion dollars, $477 billion in profits to a half a dozen oil companies. If the situation of high oil is being manipulated, how do you say that's going on?
Well, I think that there is manipulation going on in the sense that we don't have adequately competitive markets. A lot of the action that we're seeing that's driving prices up is not unrest globally in places like Nigeria or Iraq, but rather in U.S. refining markets where there is problems of capacity shortages. You've got unplanned and planned outages at refineries, and that's been a driving factor in pushing prices up, especially over the last year. And a lot of that stems from financial decision-making by the industry. They haven't been reinvesting back into their aging infrastructure. They haven't been prioritizing reliability. I'll give you one example. You know, ExxonMobil, which is the global leader, you know, every day they produce more oil than the entire Kingdom of Kuwait. They own a heck of a lot of refineries here in the United States. They spent last year $37 billion buying back their stock and paying out dividends to their shareholders. At the same time, they spent $824 million on capital investment in their U.S. downstream system, which is mainly refineries. So $824 million may sound like a big number, but it's not when you look at the scope of the industry, and especially when you look at the amount that they're spending on stock options and or stock buybacks.
Business Week writes that they're pumping cash, not oil. It has come up in the presidential debates in recent weeks. We had Republican candidate Mitt Romney, Tyson, during the Republican debate last week. You may have heard him talking about the high profits of oil companies and where they're going, where they're not going.
Big oil's making a lot of money right now, and I'd like to see them using that money to invest in refineries. Don't forget that when companies earn profit, that money's supposed to be reinvested in growth.
Okay, what we hear is we haven't built new refineries since what? Not a new one in this country since 1976 because nobody wants one in their backyard. Environmental regulations are really steep. Get off our back. We'd love to, but we can't.
Well, first of all, there's a small company out in Arizona called Arizona Clean Fuels, and they have obtained most of the necessary air quality permits to build a brand new refinery in Yuma, Arizona. And so my question is, if a small company can somehow successfully navigate America's environmental regulations, why on earth can't the world's most profitable corporation? I mean, ExxonMobil posted profits last year of $39.5 billion. I think that it is unbelievable to suggest that these extremely wealthy companies cannot afford to comply with U.S. environmental laws. And I would hate to see America's strong public health laws be sacrificed to satisfy oil companies' agenda. There's an amendment being offered by Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma in the U.S. Senate right now that would scale back some environmental protections and siting requirements for refineries to appease the oil companies.
And still, we're trying.
Environmental laws are not the problem.
Okay,
here.
So we're really trying to figure out what is going on. If it's not simple supply and demand, and we'll hear from an oil industry economist in a few minutes here, but what about on the inventory side? We're always hearing, okay, the summer driving season is coming up, and gas inventories are tight. In 1990, I read, we had gas inventories to cover 30 days supply. By 2023, now close to just 20 days supply. Why are inventories so low that any crimp in supply causes a spike in price? Why not have bigger inventories if you don't have the refining capacity?
Well, some of it has been consumer demand. I mean, people, even with gasoline prices nearly tripling over the last 5 years, motorists keep using gasoline. And a lot of that is because, you know, economists refer to it as inelastic demand. In the face of higher and higher prices, a lot of people don't have a whole lot of opportunity to greatly moderate their consumption. And so, you know, if you have to drive in order to get to work or take your kids to school or run errands on the weekends, you're kind of stuck. You have to keep driving.
The consumer's fault that gas prices are high.
Well, consumers bear some responsibility, and people, you know, and we've seen some people moderate their usage for those that can. You've seen SUV sales slacken tremendously over the last 2 years. So consumers are starting to be more responsible. But the fact is they need more financial assistance to do so. I talk to a lot of people that would love to buy a new super fuel efficient hybrid. And, you know, those tax breaks, especially for Toyota, has already run out. And so we've got plenty of big tax breaks and subsidies that continue to go to oil companies, billions of dollars a year, whereas your average household doesn't have adequate access to financial incentives to make the environmentally responsible choice.
Tyson, talk to us about profit margins here. I mean, I'm reading in different places that they're higher in this country than elsewhere. Why should that be? 1999, U.S. oil refiners, you testified, had an 18.9% margin on every gallon of refined from crude oil. By 2005, a 48.8% percent margin or cent margin on each of those. Margins here on each barrel refined than in, let's say, Singapore, which is a huge refining center in Asia. Why should the margins be higher here? Why aren't the markets taking care of that?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fundamental changes in the U.S. market that's been defined by mergers. We've allowed this wave of mergers over the last several years that has greatly consolidated control over the refining sector. You know, Exxon and Mobil used to be two huge competing companies. They were allowed to merge under the Clinton administration. That was quickly followed by Chevron and Texaco, Conoco and Phillips. The list goes on and on. And so as a result, the largest five oil companies today control about 55% of the refining market, whereas over a decade ago, they only controlled one-third. So that level of enhanced consolidation has reduced competition. And I think that that helps explain why the margins are so high in the U.S. refining sector, why the industry isn't that eager to vastly expand capacity, because they're operating in anti-competitive ways.
You make a really tough allegation here of market manipulation, that the markets are actually being, the price at which we buy gas is actually being manipulated. What do you mean? That's a tough charge.
Well, I think that the companies are just engaging in anti-competitive behavior. I think that they have financial incentive to not directly engage each other in direct competition in all sectors of the market. I think that you've got, you know, a lot of them have taken over their biggest rivals, and the federal government has allowed them to do this. And I think we've had a very weak Federal Trade Commission. We've had weak congressional oversight. And I think we ought to take a look at what the effect has been on these recent mergers. We've had several investigations, including the Government Accountability Office, which serves as kind of the watchdog of Congress. And they concluded in 2004 that recent mergers have in fact led to higher gasoline prices. And the GAO is going to be updating that. And I think that the price effect is going to be even bigger than what they concluded a couple years ago. So there's no question that mergers has reduced competition. And when you reduce competition, you just open the door to allowing companies to unilaterally engage in anti-competitive practices like unilateral withholding or other things like that.
So when the American consumer is at the pump, and we know people pay a lot more elsewhere, maybe we should pay more here, but this is going straight to oil company profits, not to some alternative tax vision of energy freedom or anything else. When they're filling that tank and putting down that $50 or whatever it is now, are you saying they're being ripped off or not?
I think they are. And you just have to look at the oil company profits, and it'd be one thing if we were getting something in return for these high prices. But the industry has already said, look, we're making record earnings off of our refineries.
That's not against the law.
We're not going to build any new ones. No, and that's the thing, is that a lot of this is not against the law. I mean, just like, you know, what Enron did in California, you know, none of the top executives ever went to jail for shutting down power plants to create artificial shortages. People went to jail for accounting schemes to cover it all up. But that's the thing, is intentionally withholding supplies from the market is not illegal.
We're looking at this hour at exactly what's really going on behind our high gas prices. We've been joined from Washington by Tyson Slocum. He's director of the energy program at Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group. We're joined now as well from Washington by Sarah Banasak. She's senior economist at the American Petroleum Institute, a trade association representing oil and natural gas companies. Sarah Banasak, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for bringing me on the show. Appreciate it.
You can well imagine that people are scratching their heads these days. You know, it's a lot of money out of consumers' pockets. If it's supply and demand and fair and straight up and that's it, okay, it hurts. We know others pay more. But if there's some kind of hanky-panky going on, people really want to understand. Tyson suggests that there is, that we've got an anti-competitive setting for these high gas prices. What do you say?
I say it's not correct, and that's exactly what the U.S. federal government watchdog concludes, that market forces are really at play, that there's plenty of competition. They've, at the request of people who are concerned, repeatedly investigate accusations of manipulation. They don't find this going on. They find very competitive markets.
Take us into it. The Wall Street Journal reports American refiners have made a pre-tax profit of $30 on each barrel of oil they produce to gasoline, three times the margin in Singapore. Now, why should that be if we've got a competitive market in a globalized age?
Well, the margins that Tyson referred to, and I suspect that article are well, are probably gross refining margins. All they do is take the price of crude oil and the price of the retail product and subtract them from one another and compare. And that doesn't include the cost of refining, which is a major reason why margins, those gross margins, would differ in this country versus another country. The cost structures for these refineries would be very, very different.
Business Week says you've got Exxon pumping cash into buying back their own stock, not into increasing the infrastructure or inventory, as we heard Mitt Romney call for in his debate remarks the other night. If we need to do more work to keep energy supplies plentiful and maybe to look at alternative energies, why buy back stock instead of investing in energy supplies?
Companies buy back stock and hold on to cash and manage their balance sheets in different ways. There's a professor at the University of Michigan who thinks that really stock buybacks are reflecting business cycles most of all. So the energy industry is very cyclical. Throughout most of the 80s and 90s, both oil and gas overall and refining specifically were very poor. They underperformed when you compare them to like all industrial companies on the Standard & Poor's. So they were performing financially much worse. So when they enter a period where they're performing, you know, sort of average along the same or slightly better than average, which is where they are now if you account for their size, they're really just slightly better than average, then they're using this period to, you know, to strengthen their balance sheet, manage their costs, but prepare for the future. So they really, you know, it's a business cycle thing. All companies, not just the energy industry, are doing these kinds of things.
But as consumers, shouldn't we look at that with a pretty jaundiced eye? I mean, if they don't spend more on building inventory capacity, infrastructure, refining capacity, that guarantees continued high prices and high profits. I mean, isn't there a kind of a self-interest in just buying back your stock instead of building it out, because you know that's going to keep prices high?
actually investing is exactly what they're doing. They invest more in net investments than they bring in net income, and that's year after year after year. Refining capacity is a great example. The number of refineries has declined in this country. The amount of refining capacity has increased. What happened is after the 70s and 80s, when there was, or 80s and 90s, a very poor performance, there were all these little tiny refineries around the United States. They shut down and they've expanded larger refineries. So we have more refining capacity than ever before. We're producing record amounts of gasoline, actually. There's no restraint on supply. Nobody's holding back because we're producing record amounts of gasoline. It's hard to keep up with record demand. Americans are driving record amounts. That's, you know, the combination of supply and demand. So there is a lot of investment going on. They've added the equivalent of about a new refinery per year in their expansion projects. And the government, the Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, projects that that's going to continue. They're going to continue expanding the refining capacity as they've done over the last 10 years.
Tyson, so what are you shouting about here? It's all hunky-dory. They're doing just what companies do in business cycles. The government says there's no manipulation. They're investing lots of money. It's all blue skies and happiness.
Well, I think I respectfully disagree, and that's why Public Citizen supports some form of a windfall profits tax, or at least revoking the billions of dollars that the oil companies receive from the taxpayer each year in the form of tax breaks, royalty relief, and Department of Energy spending programs. Because right now we have huge needs to invest in mass transit. We have to give consumers access to alternatives. A lot of people, like I said earlier, would love...
Tyson, are you there? Sounds like we may have lost our connection to Washington for just a moment. We'll work on that and get it right back. I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us from Aspen, Colorado, is Philip Verliger, founder of PK Verliger, an economics and energy consulting firm. He first advocated for a tax on gas prices all the way back in the early 1970s. Philip Verliger, thanks very much for being here.
Tom, thank you. I've been an economist since I finished at one of your Cambridge institutions in 1971, chasing this industry, and I never get it right. But I have to add two comments before talking about a gasoline tax. One, the comparison of profits in Singapore with the profits in the United States or the margins, as Tyson is making, is not quite right, because refineries in Singapore don't produce much of the high-value products that one needs. They tend to produce a lot of residual fuel oil, and that actually sells for less than crude oil. Refineries lose on it. U.S. refineries are the most sophisticated in the world. A typical refinery can produce 20% gasoline. Refineries in the United States produce now on the order of 55 or 60%. And so one sees higher margins, and that's just textbook economics. You've invested a lot more. And, you know, the cost of building a refinery in Singapore is probably a quarter to a tenth what the cost is here, because you just don't put the figures.
Let's just look domestically then, if we may, Philip.
Sure.
1999, U.S. oil refiners with an 18.9-cent margin on every gallon refined from crude. Now it's 48.8 cents in 2005, maybe higher now, 158% jump. Is that fine? No problem? Why hasn't somebody stepped in if there's competition to drive it down?
I guess this is what one gets for gray hair. In 1999, the oil industry was laying people off right and left, and we're paying the price for that now. I went to MIT. I look at the number of chemical engineers we graduated. I graduated from college in '66, a long time ago. We produced as many chemical engineers then as we did now. One of the reasons we had the mergers between ARCO and BP and Exxon and Mobil, it was that profits were so terribly low, and the industries went through and they just cut manpower left and right.
Mm.
And yes, so 19 cents, you know, the margins were 19 cents. The National Petroleum Council, of which I'm a member and is an advisory board to the president and the Secretary of Energy, warned that that if those things continued, we weren't going to have an industry. One couldn't cover costs. I think, and the second point one needs to make is.
Yeah.
David O'Reilly of Chevron, they're not expanding refining capacity because Congress is essentially pushing so much ethanol, requiring ethanol use, so that we will need less output from refineries. by 2012 or 2015 than we get right now. So, if you decide to build that Arizona Clean Fuels Refinery,
yeah.
I've talked to the people there, it might be on stream by 2014. It takes a long time. Backlogs, because we don't have the engineers, because the engineers aren't available around the world, are 5, 6, 7 years. And so, but if it's, you know, the decision to add to refining capacity right now above what's already in the works doesn't do you much good. Now, the question is on a gasoline tax. In 73, when we first faced this, I was working with Hank Hautacker, who was at Harvard, and we did the first major price elasticity study of gasoline, and as Tyson said, consumers' response to higher prices is very slow. You can't decide. I lived in Concord, and you know, you can't decide one day, well, I'm not going to drive to work in Boston if there's no rail or nothing else. You just have to drive. The what one wants to do is look at systems which give the consumer a clear signal to buy more fuel economic cars now and for a number of years into the future.
There's the environmental argument that high prices are good, even necessary, but part of that has often been based around a tax, not just super profits for Exxon and company.
I absolutely agree. We proposed in 1973 a 50 cent a gallon tax on gasoline, and we showed using macro models at the time the firm was Data Resources, that if the gasoline tax is regressive, it hurts the poor more than the rich. And so what we proposed to do was offset that by using the revenue to pay the employee portion of the OASDI tax, the employment tax, which is around 9%. So that your paycheck would jump by 9%, but you'd be paying more for gasoline. Now,
so there's a trade-off, and Philip, hold that thought because we'll go to it and look at that option, but we really want to keep focused on what's going on with the gas price in the market first, if we may, and I think we're getting our line to Washington back here, but let's let our listeners come in as well. Let's take a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Joe, you're on the air. What do you think?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And what I think is that I'll try to move through this as quickly as I can. Is that, of course, I'm from Iowa and one of the ethanol capitals of the world here, and also lived in California, and I do know that the petroleum industry had some severe issues related to MTBEs, and they pretty much had a monopoly up until a couple of years ago on the fuel additives for, you know, the biggest markets in the country, and that most of that refining capacity for that additive was in Canada. And it's also occurred to me that their pricing structure for the summer driving months has been extended by 2 months at the front end and 2 months at the tail end.
Now, what do you mean pricing structure? Shouldn't the markets just drive the price in any season? What do you mean structure?
Well, according to we've been following this issue for a number of years now, basically with the higher prices for 2 years. And it's been standard industry propaganda that, you know, prices go up at Memorial Day and they come back down at Labor Day due to the summer driving months.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And what I've noticed over the last 2 years, last year and this year, that the pricing started, the trend, it was trending up at the beginning of April, and then it started its trend down not till late October.
So extending that higher price season, if that's a fact, Philip Verlager, what do you say?
Tom, Mother Nature's played a really rotten trick on consumers. The environmental authorities require that the volatility of gasoline be lowered in summer months.
Right.
You remember years ago when you filled your car, you could smell the gasoline
yep,
coming
out. Yeah, see it all evaporating up into the sky.
Evaporating. Mm-hmm. What you do is you take the butane out.
Mm-hmm.
That lowers the volatility.
Mm-hmm.
So that historically the industry has taken butane out starting just before Labor Day, before Memorial Day, and putting it in just after Labor Day. Well, they've gradually been rolling back that window. And so the RVPs, with reed vapor pressures, the technical term,
yep.
have to be lower beginning in April and last until around the 1st of October. And Joe's right. I mean, but it's a dirty trick that Mother Nature's played and due to the environmental regulations. I frankly think it's a good regulation, but it does cut the supply just when the demand goes up.
We've got the perspective. Tyson Slocum, I think you're back with us in Washington. We're hearing an awful lot of defense of these prices. I'm not sure your offense is holding up well here, Tyson.
Oh, I think it definitely is. I mean, there's no question that the oil companies are making these record profits. And I'd like to respond to Philip's point about raising the gas tax and dedicating the proceeds of that tax to cutting payroll taxes so that workers would be offset some of the effect of the regressive nature of the gas tax. Well, there's a lot of people in this country that don't pay payroll taxes, like the elderly, like the unemployed, the disabled, students. And also, ideally, you would want additional revenues from the gas tax to fund alternative transportation and alternative fuels and energy efficiency. If you end up spending all that money to offset the regressive nature of it, it's very inefficient.
But Tyson, let's not go straight to taxes because it misses the market that's at work or not at work right now. Sarah Banasak says, yes, they're buying back stock. Companies do that in cycles. They had their downtime. Now they're in fat city. This is the time for them to do it. She says, they're doing what they can on infrastructure. Philip Verliger says, why should they spend more on refineries if ethanol is coming on? I mean, the case is being made that the companies are doing pretty much just the right thing and prices are just where they ought to be.
Sure. Well, the problem is that what's the use of these high market, these high price signals? I mean, the economic concept behind a price signal is consumers pay a really high price because it sends a signal to the market that, hey, this is a very profitable industry to be in, so it sends a signal to continue to expand and to get other people into that market. Well, if the oil industry is folding up their hands and saying, well, you know what, we're making these record profits at the refineries, but we're not going to build any new ones because right when they come online, demand is going to be going down. So you've got the situation, this window of a couple of years.
Going down because other fuels will be coming on stream and that'll be the end of
right.
the party.
And so you've got this window of a couple of years where the industry is implicitly acknowledging that they're going to be cashing in huge windfalls. And the question is, from a policy standpoint, is that right? And that's why Public Citizen supports some form of higher tax temporarily on the oil companies to dedicate that revenue stream to the kind of needed investments that in alternative energies and to mass transit into energy efficiency, because clearly the industry isn't doing it. This isn't about denying the ability of the industry to earn a fair and reasonable return for their hard work and their ingenuity and their investment.
Sarah Banasak, is that it? The oil industry sitting back and cashing in on the end of the oil era?
No, there's absolutely no windfall profits. You can take any financial measure that you want for
the biggest profits in history. How can they not be called windfall? I mean, they're gigantic.
Sure, I bet Tyson is earning record amounts in his salary, too. Hopefully that is going up. But when you adjust for the size of these companies and compare it to other industries, they're just slightly above average right now. For instance, if you look at earnings per dollar sold, then they're just slightly above average. In 2006, it was about 9.5 cents on the dollar compared to 8.2 cents on the dollar. Some of the highest grossing companies or industries would be in the 22% range.
We're looking this hour at what's really going on behind our high gas prices, trying to figure out where is the market working, where may it not be, how do these high prices set the country up for the century ahead. It's been a topic on the campaign trail. Here's John Edwards, Democratic presidential candidate on the profits of big oil companies during a debate on June 3rd.
I think there ought to be an investigation of the oil and gas companies by the Justice Department. I think if the laws that presently exist don't deal with this problem and price manipulation, there should be some change in the antitrust laws.
And then there's John McCain, Republican, talking about America's reliance on foreign oil.
We've got to reduce our dependence on imported oil. We can do it through a wide variety of alternative fuels, but we have to be serious about it, and we're going to have to go to places where we have never gone before.
Let's take a call from St. Matthews, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? I appreciate you taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you think?
I got a couple of comments to make. Number one is oil and gas are not like other commodities. Everything in this country, the whole economy depends on fuel to run trucks, trains, planes, everything, anything that's got to be transported. And but that's one thing. It's not like Walmart or anything.
Right. Everybody depends on it. Let me ask you, Kevin, we've got a lot cheaper gas here than they do in many other countries around the world, so should we just, you know, be happy?
Well, what you got, Tom, in rural states, just like South Carolina, I mean, we're not like Washington or New York or San Francisco, where you got trains and you got buses and you got subways. I mean, people have to drive 40, 50 miles to work, and you take a man that's making $400 a week, and he's got a wife and two kids at home. He's having to pay $150 a week for gas. There's no way people can survive like that. There's a lot of people that are going to go under. They got to decide whether they're going to buy gas to go to work or whether they're going to pay for insurance on their car. And if they don't get the insurance, then they're criminals. So,
yeah. Kevin, you make it very real and take it right to that family bottom line, and I appreciate that. Philip Verlinger, I mean, there it is. You know, you've got people, some people who can just jump on a train or a bus, some others who can pay that big money for the full tank of gas, but many others for whom this is a real pinch, and if there's anything not working about the market, they really want to know about it.
You're absolutely right. Last week I was doing some work with data on consumption of gasoline by county versus income, and what you find is for people with median incomes around $20,000-$25,000, the rise in gasoline prices from February to May, the peak in May, has just been disastrous. They've seen the share of their income that they have to spend on gasoline go from 5 to around 10%. You go to the wealthy counties where the median income is around $80,000 or $85,000, and there's essentially an imperceptible change. And so Kevin's exactly right. The county at the bottom of the list in terms of income distribution is Clay County, Kentucky. It's a very rural county. That is where the pain is. We see it in the retail sales from Walmart. Last week, Sachs said, gee, they had a very great April. Walmart had a pretty miserable April. And that's part of the reason why you want to, if you're going to do a tax, you have to recycle it. And Slocum's right. You have to take care of the people on Social Security, you have to take care of the people not covered by that, but that you want to keep the prices up, and you want to make the people in rural South Carolina and Kentucky and so on whole. And that's why, as I said, I started doing this in 1973, and that's what, it's 2007. We've been doing this 34 years. And have I made any progress? No.
We see the bruises on your forehead there. Tyson Slocum, let me turn to you then. If it just doesn't pinch as much in affluent parts of the country, maybe countries with a lot of parts of the country with a lot of political power, is that why we're not seeing more action on the kind of problems that you're alleging?
Well, I think that the political power of the oil industry, like any big powerful industry, plays a very big role. I mean, there's a reason why companies have political action committees and hire armies of lobbyists. It's to influence the political process. And since 2000, the oil industry has given over $105 million in campaign contributions. So that's not out of charity. It's because they're expecting something in return. And so that definitely plays a role. And in terms of the policies that we need, like I said earlier, it'd be one thing if the high prices we were paying were being reinvested back into the communities, back into providing people with access to alternatives. In Europe, they pay over $4 a gallon in taxes. In the United States, we pay less than 40 cents a gallon in taxes. Those high taxes in Europe are actively subsidizing access to mass transit. Now, I'm not advocating raising our taxes to $4, but what I'm saying is, if the oil industry is going to prioritize spending their money on stock buybacks, I understand they need to take care of their shareholders, but I would much rather see the United States enact some sort of temporary income tax surcharge on oil company profits, dedicating that money to investing in mass transit, greater access to alternative fuel and fuel-efficient vehicles and energy efficiency. That's the kind of investments that we need, because right now the federal government doesn't have a whole lot of money to spend on these things.
The new energy bill that's brought up in the Senate yesterday would make price gouging in the oil industry a federal crime. So they could go after it if it were actually there. But I've got to say, I mean, I've heard you today making some kind of broad allegations of too many mergers and, you know, they're not plowing enough back in. But I'm not sure if there's a sharp enough edge on your critique here to really go after the industry with a kind of price gouging charge.
Well, the Federal Trade Commission in 2001 took a look at this. And Sarah mentioned earlier that the government has taken a look at this over years and not found any evidence of wrongdoing. And she's right. But what the government has found evidence of is anti-competitive practices. So, for example, in 2001, the Federal Trade Commission found evidence that oil companies were intentionally withholding supply, waiting until prices went up until releasing it. And they interviewed this one executive who said, look, I would rather sell less gasoline into the market and earn a much higher profit margin on that less amount, then flood the market with surplus and earn a lower margin. That in of itself is not illegal. And the question is, can we start to do things to discourage that kind of unilateral withholding, that kind of anti-competitive behavior? Because if we had a truly competitive market, you wouldn't be able to unilaterally make a decision not to sell into the market because your competitor would step in and provide to that market. The fact that exists shows that we don't have an adequately competitive market. And the anti-price gouging statute that's being considered by Congress, it's very modest. It only would take effect after the President of the United States declares a national emergency, so in the wake of a Hurricane Katrina. And I think we can all agree that companies should not be responding to a natural disaster by significantly raising prices to the point where they're making a lot of money. So it's a very modest first step, I think.
Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just remember when I was younger, my grandpa would always tell me that there would always be gas because eventually the markets would push the price up so high no one could afford the last drop. And
right.
I'm a pretty big believer in a free market, personally. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me with gas is that the lack of freedom and the lack of subsidies, lack of ability to buy fuel efficiency cars, like for such, you know, example, me, I'm only 21 years old, my line of credit, I couldn't possibly afford to buy, a hybrid car of any sort or something better. So it seems to me that I'm, dependent on gas and that the federal government, I mean, I can't see why we're having the debate that the federal government should or shouldn't do something that, the American people are dependent upon. You know, it has to be regulated in some way or another, unfortunately, just because of the dependency.
Yeah. Well, maybe, though that's not where we've gone yet. Let me go to Sarah Banasek with that. Sarah, I mean, you hear what Jonathan's grandpa says, that last drop nobody will be able to afford. But how, as an oil industry economist and an American citizen, how do you look at this? I mean, if the industry shouldn't build more refineries in economic terms because ethanol and other things may come on, there's a huge opportunity here for squeezing the consumer as the oil industry kind of peters out. Should, whether it's the market's being manipulated or not, should the country let these giant profits go to the oil companies, or is there some more fundamental interest in stepping in, as both Philip and Tyson are suggesting, with taxes that take some of that gravy and funnel it into an energy future?
Yeah. We rely on food, too, for life and death, but we don't regulate food markets. And when you have a freeze in Florida and the price of orange juice goes up, we're not worried about price gouging. We understand that there's been, a disruption to supply. So we allow the prices to go up.
But we don't have to drink orange juice. If they didn't, build more orange juice refineries, I suppose somebody else would.
Actually, consumers, it's one thing that is actually disappointing about Public Citizen, which is supposed to be a consumer advocacy group, is that they don't have anything on their website to direct consumers how to become more efficient, because we're not
I'm asking you about oil companies, not consumers. We've got that perspective. We could have more conservation.
Okay.
But if we're in an era of shortage and change, and you're not going to build more refineries, and inventories are what they are, there seems to be a huge opportunity here to squeeze that consumer in if these are the last years of the oil age. Should the country step in, as Philip and Tyson both say, and put taxes in there so that some of that gravy goes into the future, not just into shareholders' pockets?
No, there's no windfall profit to tax. These companies are average.
Oh, come on, but windfall, schminfall, you got billions and billions, world record profits. I mean, no matter what you call it.
You're the largest. Here, let me give you an analogy that might help you, might allow a lot of people to see the difference. If you go to your local hardware store and buy something, then the local hardware store is going to make so much money that year. If you go to a large chain store, that large chain store is going to make a lot more because it's a large company. These are the largest publicly held companies. And who are they held by? The public. They're held. 41% of their stock is owned by retirement funds, teachers, yeah, policemen.
It just seems
you
too simple a story, a response for the question I'm asking. Philip?
Let me put a little background on this. One, the profits do fluctuate a lot more in the oil industry. And some of the profits, when we teach economics, we call rents. That is more, a payment to a product that's more than needs to be brought forward. And Prime Minister Thatcher, the paragon of virtue for conservatives, introduced a tax in the UK on oil produced in the North Sea. Now, the British have this quaint argument that, well, the oil's in the North Sea, and so it's kind of the government has a claim on it. You know, we essentially give it away in the Gulf Coast. And that Nigel Lawson, who was the her finance advisor, raised that tax rate to 90%. Now, this is on production from the North Sea,
okay,
and it was 90% applied to that revenue, the price that was above and beyond the cost associated with production, depreciation and everything else. Taxes on rents, and one can argue that there are some in the refining. It's not so much Exxon. The FTC actually forced Exxon out substantially out of the refining business with the merger.
Yeah.
And created a company called Valero, which is one of the top five now, which
right,
wasn't there in 75. So taxes, you know, if one sat down and looked at refining margins, said that there is a normal, and you know, I've been following the commodities now for 20 years, mm, and, you know, the normal range on gasoline is something like $8.
Okay.
And it's right now around 30. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, there is a windfall there, or a rent. Windfalls, there's not really a windfall word in economics. And it could be taxed. Other than the United States, conservatives and liberal politicians across the globe in free economies have looked at those for raising money.
But do you see, Philip, let me ask you, that's a possibility. You've laid it out and how you would do it. But I'm reading here Business Week magazine. This isn't exactly, Pravda. And they're looking at how, the chairman and CEO of Exxon telling analysts that they're all about, their business model begins with discipline now. The focus on returns, not chasing marginally profitable oil wells, not pouring money into new refineries, not staffing up aggressively. That sounds like kind of stepping on the windpipe here because, you know, if they don't spend more on that, that's going to mean a little less gas and higher profits.
Well, I'm going to come out strongly and defend Rex. Rex Tillerson, the CEO.
Okay.
Exxon has been historically a worldwide operation. They are extraordinarily disciplined at developing carefully, with real prudence, environmental prudence, very expensive, very difficult fields like Sakhalin in Russia, where nobody else could do it. Exxon could do it. Alaska, they were the company that did it.
Yeah, but Mitt Romney says, where's that spending now when profits are so high? Shouldn't this be the time to do it?
Absolutely. And you know where most of the oil is found? It's found in places like Kazakhstan, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and so on. And you know what's happening around the world? Where about 80% of the reserves are, they're hanging up the sign saying, no vacancy. Exxon's not wanted. What Tillerson's saying is, look, there are a lot of opportunities where a company with our skills can go. One of them is in the deep Gulf of Mexico, right into Mexico. Chevron's successfully found a lot of oil on the border at a very deep, I think it's 3,000 or 4,000 meters. It's incredibly deep. The Mexicans have oil, and they talk about the big straw because we may be sucking the oil from Mexico. But Mexico nationalized its oil industry. Pemex is the only firm that can develop it. Pemex is barely competent, can't go into those deep waters.
So they couldn't invest more if they wanted to, you're saying, of Exxon?
Well, they couldn't. There are very few places they can go where they can earn a return on their investment that is better than, say, a treasury bill.
Or better than buying back their own stock.
And so they buy back their own stocks because of all these no vacancy signs around the world.
Well, what a picture, though. American citizens are then paying for that. It turns into Exxon profit, though you know, even if it starts out at no trespassing signs.
Well, it's not just American citizens. The thing that really bothers me and bothers a number of political commentators is it's Al-Qaeda. It's, you know, we're paying once at the pump for the gasoline, and then we turn around and pay again because we get our people shot. I mean, you know, I'm perfectly happy to see the profits go into oil companies' pockets. I am much more nervous about profits going to some of these Middle Eastern countries, Iran, for example, where the money then gets used to build nuclear bombs and maybe going to blow us up.
Philip, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. And I got to say on this one, I'm afraid this one, I just don't think we've cracked. We're going to have to come back and look at it again. I'm grateful to each of you for being here today. Philip Verliger, joining us from Aspen, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Sarah Banasak at the American Petroleum Institute, senior economist there. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
And Tyson Slocum at Public Citizen in Washington. Thanks for being here, Tyson.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.